Chapter 79. After the war, Vincent once again established himself as an all-purpose investor. He didn't have any particular company to front for this, but trotted around the globe as an extremely wealthy enthusiast, picking up bits here and there of whatever it was that seemed to interest him. And I was his personal private secretary.
"I want to keep you close, Harry," he explained. "You're just so good for me."
As his secretary, I had access to information far beyond anything I'd possessed in my last life. Documents he didn't even know existed were continually fed to me from banks, universities, CEOs, charities looking for investment, governments and brokers, and Vincent, in an omission which I can only class as a fatal mistake, didn't even bother to check on them. He was used to me. I was his pet, utterly reliable, utterly dependent, utterly harmless. I was subservient, grateful that he was paying me so much to do so little, excited by the people I met, and, if asked my job title, would reply proudly that I was not a secretary at all, but rather a corporate executive working for Mr. Rankis, a fix-it man travelling across the globe with him, living the high life, following in his voluminous coattails. He treated me very well, both as an employee and as a friend, once again buying my affection through the usual pattern of free dinners, holidays, golf, and, gods, how I loathed golf, and the regular trips he paid for us to take to his favourite club in the Caribbean. These were all part of my corruption, and so I went along with it to show willing. I like to tell myself I could have been a good golfer, if only I'd given a damn, but perhaps the simple truth is that there are some skills which experience cannot buy. We shared stories of the war, friends, acquaintances, drinks, slept in the same compartment on overnight trains, sat side by side on the plains across the Atlantic, swapped seats as we drove from meeting to meeting up and down first the east, then the west coast of America. We stood together above Niagara Falls, one of the few sights on this planet which, no matter how perfectly I recall it, never fails to take my breath away. And when working together on business trips, our hotel rooms were adjoining, a connecting door between, so we could share a midnight drink when inspiration struck. Many people assumed we were lovers, and I considered what I would do if Vincent proposed the same. Having been through so much, the prospect of sleeping with him was nothing to me at all, and I would have done it without a second thought. The question that remained of the matter was whether I could justify it based on the persona I was currently wearing of Harry August, nice boy from Leeds, raised in an age when homosexuality wasn't merely illegal, it was entirely taboo. If the matter came up, I resolved to have a good, public, old-fashioned crisis of religious faith about it, and if the question still remained, I would succumb, only after a great deal of guilt and quite possibly an unhappy love affair. There was no point making things too easy for him. Thankfully, the issue never arose, though everyone, including myself, seemed to be waiting for the moment. Vincent's attitude to love, it appeared, was, as he himself had stated, strictly therapeutic. Destructive passion was foolish, irrational desire was a waste of time, and his mind was always on higher things. The first whiff of the higher things his mind was on came in 1948, when, as was so often the way, Vincent walked into the small room that served as my London office, slumped down into the chair on the other side of the desk, stuck his feet on the tabletop between my heavy in-tray and my impressive collection of coloured inks, and said,
"I'm going to inspect something the boffins are working on tomorrow. Want to come?"
I laid down the document I'd been working on and steepled my fingers carefully. Usually, business trips with Vincent ended in a severe hangover, a large check, and an overwhelming sense of déjà vu. But this time, the vagueness and lightness with which he described his intentions intrigued me.
"Where is this project?"
"Switzerland."
"You're going to Switzerland tomorrow?"
"This afternoon, actually," he replied.
"I'm sure I sent you a memo."
"You haven't sent me a memo for 2 years," I pointed out mildly. "You just do things and wait for me to catch up."
"And hasn't it worked brilliantly?" he demanded. "Isn't it marvellous?"
"What's in Switzerland?"
"Oh, something they're working on with heavy water and particles and that stuff. You know I don't bother with these kinds of things."
Absolutely, I knew he didn't bother with these kinds of things. He'd gone to great lengths to make it clear how little he bothered with these kinds of things. But now I was utterly fascinated, for as the person who planned nearly every aspect of Vincent's life from morning to night,
Switzerland presented a tantalizing glimpse of that holy grail, a secret that had been kept from me. I'd spotted holes in Vincent's schedules, many weeks set aside as holiday or family business or wedding, and how many weddings there'd been. But as I was never required to make travel arrangements for these events, I had never known the full details. Now, I wondered, was it Switzerland with its heavy water and particles and that stuff? Was this the black hole into which so much of Vincent's money had been quietly diverted when he thought I wasn't looking? I don't think I want to go to Switzerland this afternoon. I was so good at lying, I barely even had to hear the words I spoke out loud. So good at deceiving and being deceived, I knew already what Vincent's reply would be. Come on, Harry! I know you're not doing anything. I may have plans with a beautiful young lady interested in my tales of high finance and dirty bars. Philosophically speaking, you may. You may have all sorts of options. You may have herpes. But the fact of the matter is, Harry, in simple empirical terms, you don't. So stop pissing around and get your hat. I stopped pissing around and got my hat and hoped he saw how irritated I was at having to do any of these things. Switzerland. I find Switzerland most appealing between the ages of 52 and 71. Much younger than that, and the clean air, healthy living, reserved manners and somewhat bland cooking puts me off. Any older, and all of the above become a depressing contrast to my decaying body and imminent demise. However, between the ages of 52 and 71, especially if I'm feeling hearty for my age, Switzerland is indeed a very pleasant place to retire to, complete with bracing breezes, clear pools, and occasionally stunning scenery to walk beneath or between, and very, very rarely over. Vincent had a car waiting for us at the airport. You hired this yourself? Harry, I'm not entirely dependent on you to look after things, you know. I know, I replied. Philosophically speaking, that is. He scowled and smiled all at once and got into the driving seat. We drove up and round, and then up a little further, and then round a little further, and then, to my incredible irritation, down a lot and up again. Navigation on the tight hairpin roads that wind through mountains has always frustrated me. Eventually, we began climbing higher than we'd climbed before, until the trees turned to sharp-needled pines and frost began to glimmer in the sweep of the headlights. I looked down sheer drops into valleys sprinkled with lights, and then up at a sky bursting with stars and blurted, "Bloody hell! Where are we going? I'm not dressed for skiing." "You'll see. Good grief! If I'd known you'd complain this much, I'd have left you back at the airport." It was nearly 1 in the morning when we reached our destination. A chalet, with a slanting wooden roof and lights already on behind the wide glass windows. There wasn't snow on the ground, but it crackled with frost as I got out of the car, and my breath puffed in the air. A woman waved from the top balcony of the chalet as Vincent slammed the car door shut, then vanished inside to greet us. Vincent scurried with a familiar step down the narrow cobbled path to a side door, which was unlocked, and gestured me in. The air inside was wonderfully warm, tinted with wood smoke from an open fire. The woman appeared at the top of some stairs, apparently bursting with joy. "Mr. Rankis, it's so good to see you again." She hugged him. He hugged her. And I briefly wondered if there was something more to their relationship than just affection. Then, "You must be Harry. Such a pleasure, such a pleasure." Her accent was German-Swiss, her age perhaps 30. She hurried us into the living room, where indeed a fat fire roared in the grate, and sat us down to a meal of cold meats, hot potato and warm wine. I was too tired and hungry to interrogate my hosts, and when Vincent finally declared with a slap on his knees, "Right, busy day tomorrow," I only put in a token grumble and went straight to bed. I woke the following morning with a start. He was standing, fully dressed for the cold, at the end of my bed, just staring at me. I didn't know how long he'd been there, watching me. He had a pair of gloves dangling down from his sleeves, sewn on with a long piece of string, like a mother might sew her child's gloves together. But there was no sign of dampness on his trousers or boots, no indication he'd been outside. For a long while, he just looked at me, until, shuffling upright, I stammered, "Vincent? What is it?" For a second, I thought he was going to say something else. Then, with a half-shake of his head and a little shuffle to the door, he replied, not looking at me, "Time to get up, Harry. Busy, busy day." I got up and didn't bother with a shower. The world outside was blue-grey with a gentle frost. The air bit hard, promising snow. The woman waved from the balcony as we climbed back into Vincent's little car, and then we drove up again through thinning pine trees and jutting rock, the heater in the car on at full blast, neither of us saying a word. We didn't go far. It can't have been more than 10 minutes out before Vincent made a sharp right and turned into what I first assumed was the entrance to a mine. A short tunnel led to a concrete car park surrounded by sheer rock walls on all sides, some parts of which had been covered with chain fencing against crumbling. A single small sign declared in French, German and English, "Private property, no ramblers, please." A single security guard, dressed in a fur-lined blue coat, the bulge of his pistol well hidden beneath its shapeless bulk, greeted us with a polite nod of recognition as we parked among the very few cars and very few spaces. A grey door in a grey cliff wall was opened as we approached, a security camera, many, many decades ahead of its time, peering down at us as we passed. I had questions, but didn't feel that I could ask them. We descended a corridor of stone cut from the walls of the mountain itself, lined with sluggish burning lanterns. Our breath steamed on the air, but as we went further down, rather than grow colder, a warm moisture began to tingle against my skin. I heard voices rising from below, echoing against the hard, round walls, and as we descended one way, three men, pushing an empty sled, came up the other way. They were talking loudly, but as Vincent approached, they fell silent, and remained so until we were deeper into the mountain, out of earshot. By now, I could hear the gentle hiss of air vents, the rattling of pipes, and the heat was taking on an unnatural mechanical quality, a little too high and damp to have been designed for simple human comfort. The number of people was increasing, men and women of all ages, who all seemed to recognize Vincent and then look away. There were quiet traces of security, too, more men in thick coats, guns under their arms and batons on their hips. "What is this place?" I asked at last, when the sound of voices was enough to muffle the breakage of quiet that my words entailed. "Do you understand quantum physics?" he asked briskly, as we rounded a corner and paused by a blast door for it to be opened. "Don't be ridiculous. You know I don't." He gave a patient sigh and ducked beneath the rising door into an even warmer cave. "Well then, I shall keep it simple. Let us say that you observe a waterfall and ask yourself how it came into being. The water flowed downwards and eroded the rock, you conclude. On the higher side of the waterfall, the rock was hard and did not crumble, but on the downward slope, the rock was soft and collapsed beneath the river rushing over it. Having made this deductive leap, you further conclude that water must always flow downhill, and it must erode, and that friction changes energy, and energy changes matter, and so on and so forth. Are you with me?" "I think so." Did he miss me then? Did he miss the Harry August he had argued with in Cambridge and who had cried claptrap to his daft ideas? I think, perhaps, he did. "Your fault, Vincent, for killing me. Twice." "Well then, let us take it another step. Let us say that you take an atom in the universe and you observe it closely. This atom, you say, is made of protons, neutrons and electrons. And from this, you begin to deduce that a proton must have a positive charge and an electron a negative, and these two attract. And you say that a neutron binds itself to a proton and a force must be exerted to prevent the attractive pull between all these from causing the atom to collapse in on itself. And from that, you can deduce..." He paused, searching for a word. "Yes?" "Everything." Said so softly. Eyes fixed on some other place. "You can deduce everything from a single atom, a single point in time and space. One can examine the fundamental stuff of the universe and conclude, by sheer mathematical process, everything that was, everything that is, everything that must be. Everything." Another door opened. A room even hotter than the others, fans working desperately to keep it cool. And there it was. Nearly 7 stories high, scaffolding running up to its topmost level, men and women, hundreds of them, swarming over its every detail. The air tasted of electricity, smelled of electricity. The noise was almost deafening. He handed me a radioactivity badge, more advanced than anything I'd worn in Pietrok 112, nearly 20 years from now, nearly 200 years ago, and over the roar shouted, "This is the quantum mirror!" I looked, and it was beautiful. The quantum mirror. Look into it too deep, and God is looking right back at you. And it was nearly finished.